train layout when they were supposed to be doing their homework. Mr. Harris raised fancy guppies, English lace, Spanish dancer, blue-tailed tuxedo. They eat their young, too. But since Mr. Harris was not, presumably, in need of conversation starters with Mrs. Harris, it wasn't as shocking. Most dads and granddads had home workshops where they preferred to be left alone. Periodically, a bulbous table lamp turned on a wood lathe would emerge, or a fretwork knick-knack shelf fresh from the jigsaw. Mom would hang the shelf or place the lamp, and there the item remained for a certain length of time. Afterward, it could be found in the attic. My paternal grandfather made things out of pipe and pipe fittings. A banister, a railing around his yard, the legs for a card table. Grandma was dead, so these stayed put. Hobbies are less common now. Or, like our little guilts, they've grown huge. We turn our hobbies into passions. You start with an ordinary 5,000-bottle collection of Grand Crus in the custom-built walk-in wine cellar, and the next thing you know, you own a vineyard. Follow your passion. And not just any vineyard, but a vineyard in a place where no one has ever thought to make wine, such as the Amazon rainforest. Hobbies are private things. Passions demand to be conveyed. We are not a private generation. Our hobbies make great TV. Reign of Terroir. Mr. Harris's guppies would not make great TV. Or maybe I'm wrong. Tomorrow on Mr. Harris Fish Hoarder, they eat their young. But Mr. Harris was too self-conscious to be on television, and we're too self-conscious not to be. Self-consciousness is our salient trait. This would be on full display in a few years when we were raising consciousness of ourselves and achieving a higher level of consciousness of ourselves. In the meantime, we self-consciously quit riding our bicycles. We had just gotten new bikes. We had saved every grandparental birthday and Christmas $5 bill and Dad's change from the top of the dresser, pushed lawnmowers for crabby old people, done odd jobs like tearing down the McKay garage and pedaled around paper routes on our antique balloon tire Schwinn's with big dumb wire baskets attached to their cowhorn handlebars. Or, doing even harder work, we had wheedled our moms and dads. Finally, we got what we called an English racing bicycle, nowadays called a bicycle, with cool skinny tires, neat drop-down handlebars, no basket, nifty handbrakes, and three gears. But when the summer after eighth grade was over, we put our English racing bicycles in the garage, and we left them there. A high school student couldn't ride a bicycle any more than a high school student could be dropped off by his mother right in front of the place where he was going. She had to stop and let him out blocks away. We'd walk. Joe Brody hitchhiked. That summer, I was on another scenic picnic with my family at the state park with the limestone outcroppings. The park also had broad fields of mown grass like a golf course, but without Dad yelling, "Watch the hell what you're doing, you'll get hit by a golf ball." I was running across one of these fields, just running, for the heck of it, utterly thoughtless, or not quite utterly, because I remember thinking, was this maybe the last time I would ever just run for the heck of it? And sure enough, when I started high school, there was President Kennedy's President's Council on Youth Fitness, taking the fun out of running. Not all that tempts your wandering eyes and heedless hearts is lawful prize. Thomas Gray, Ode on the Death of a Favorite Cat Drowned in a Tub of Goldfishes. 7. All That Glisters. Mr. Biedermeier, who took a walk around the block every evening before dinner, began wearing Bermuda shorts and knee socks. It was a new era. Things were changing. For a long time, nothing had happened in the world. At least, nothing much that the baby boom noticed. The launching of Sputnik had caught our attention and caused a brief flurry of interest in science and math, until we discovered this meant more dividing fractions. Billy Stumpf's dog's name on an artillery shell was my strongest impression of the Korean War. Nothing may explain a lot about the baby boom. Ike was the president. Khrushchev was the dictator. Pius was the pope. In December 1959, Life produced a special edition, The Fabulous Fifties. And I thought, what? We'd been living in a steady state universe. Meanwhile, grown-ups had been experiencing, at the speed of light, big bangs, red shifts, black holes, and general theories of relativity. Old people had gone from a world with the noise of horses' hooves in the street to a world where the noise was Elvis. Only we, who had been born after 1945, knew that life was stable, fixed, reliable, safe, and boring. So the baby boom has always believed passionately in change. What's the harm in it? So far, being a freshman in high school didn't seem like real change, except JFK or no JFK, I was on my own 50-mile hike because I was too self-conscious to ride my bicycle. The nation may have entered upon the sunlit uplands of the American century, but a 14-year-old doesn't have an âge d'or, especially if they've got you taking French. School had become a little more confusing. High school teachers couldn't seem to leave it at teaching. They talked a lot. Miss Benton, the French teacher, talked about the significance of French nuclear weapons in Charles de Gaulle's Force de Frappe. She'd been to France the summer after she got out of college. Power of milkshake? The beginning with French textbook didn't have much in the way of a glossary. Mr. Keeble, the history teacher, said, America has a vigorous young president. The president was in his 40s. His wife gave a televised tour of the White House full of all the old furniture you could shake a stick at. Miss Benton dressed like Jackie Kennedy and tried to talk like her, to the extent that a strong Midwestern accent allowed. What did that sound like in French? Miss Benton wore pillbox hats, oversized sunglasses, pointy shoes, and skirts that ended a little closer than skirts usually did to teacher knees. She had a huge rear end. Mr. Keeble could get into a heated debate, mostly with himself, about Koh Mui, Matsu, the Bay of Pigs, and Laos. He wanted us to ask questions. And we had some. The Ohio, America, and the World textbook didn't have much in the way of maps. The First Lady sounded like she was talking baby talk. Marilyn Monroe talked baby talk, too. What was it with important adults talking baby talk and urging us to talk like adults about important things such as the Cold War, counterinsurgency, and the Green Berets? But if I raised my hand to ask whether it was, maybe, kind of embarrassing to make our toughest, most lethal military unit wear force de frappe things on their heads, Mr. Keeble smirked. Then he caught himself. Teachers were supposed to engage us. Education in the 1960s couldn't seem to leave it at educating. Engagement with students was the first step education took as it meandered off toward relevance. Education was changing. It worked. The baby boom has engaged in all sorts of things. And we consider ourselves so relevant to the world that we think we can stop rising sea levels by separating the glass from the plastic in our trash. But it's difficult, in retrospect, to say what penetrated the mind of a high school freshman. I don't recall having much mind, and what I did have wandered. Mr. Keeble went on at length about the new frontier. It lacked Comanches, gunfighters, and cattle stampedes, but had the Peace Corps. I couldn't picture myself dramatically wounded and bleeding to death while bravely urging Sergeant Shriver to leave me behind and repair the village well. What did impress itself on the nascent 1960s adolescent brain was all the talk that things were changing. Things like soldiers and Girl Scouts wearing the same berets. We could do better than that. The seed of the baby boom's "you ain't seen nothing yet" was planted. And the growth of boredom was nurtured. It had sprouted in first grade and now began to bear fruit and has done so ever since. Ask baby boomers to explain the most dramatic episodes in our ever-transforming opinions, attitudes, careers, marriages, and ways of life, and we'll tell you, when we're feeling honest, I got bored. Algebra was very boring. There are some things you don't want to know is not a baby boom phrase. We're a knowing generation. Nonetheless, if such things did exist, I suspected that what X over the square root of Y equals was one of them. Mr. Wiley, the algebra teacher, was old. Engagement with students probably sounded to him like some kind of violation of the Mann Act. Education did not meander for Mr. Wiley. We'd have to look at the Mad magazine we had tucked inside the Algebra Now textbook if we wanted relevance. There was a future irony awaiting us in the algebra class boredom. The baby boom's billionaires are the kids with dandruff, smudged eyeglasses, unmatched socks, and misbuttoned shirts who joined math club freshman year and now commute by helicopter from Greenwich and Palo Alto, where they live with their generation-wise smoking hot third wives. Software algorithms and formulae for finance market mathematical models. Damn you, Mr. Keeble, for never mentioning them. Explain why ironic vies with easily bored as the typical baby boom frame of mind. I was bored by my old friends. I had nothing in common with them now. Billy Stump was on the Westside High JV football team, although he was still second string, so he could say hello to me in the halls. Bobby Stump was in eighth grade. Steve Penske was becoming hoody, slicking his hair, turning up his jacket collar, and smoking cigarettes closer to the school entrance than was allowed. Johnny McKay had moved and went to Northside High. He rooted for the Northside Polar Bears instead of the Westside Cowboys. We're a mobile generation. Or, as Johnny McKay put it, why didn't Dad move us to California? The baby boom would expand American geographical and social mobility. Americans used to head outward and upward. We'd beat that. We'd head downward and backward, too. Downward all the way to the hollers of Appalachia, as the folk music mania was about to prove, and backward to the tenement slums about which our grandparents had kept us ignorant. So ignorant that in my hipster 20s, when I moved to Greenwich Village and saw my first rat, I left a bowl of water out for it because I thought the kid next door had lost his pet. Our identities themselves are mobile, like our biker gangs of fellow retired business executives. Frequent change of friends is necessary, though eventually we go on Facebook and get back in touch. Hey, what you been doing since Miss Burbage sent you to the principal? Joe Brody was in my homeroom. The half hour before lunch was occupied by homeroom, the purpose of which was unclear. Attendance was taken. This meant you could have skipped the first half of the school day, as Joe Brody found out, while the rest of us lacked the courage to act on his findings. Important announcements were made over the school PA system by someone using broadcast equipment borrowed from Steve Penske's ham radio set. Our generation has certain shortcomings. I blame the school PA system. Probably the important announcement was, all students reporting to room 110 at 3 p.m. will be given a dose of common sense. Anna Klein was also in my homeroom. She saved a place for me in the high school cafeteria. Not that there was a crowd trying to sit with the freshmen, although there might have been if Anna hadn't worn her hair in a Martha Graham bun and walked like a duck, the way girls who take too many dance classes do. Anna's cousin, Tim Minsky, sat with us. He didn't have dandruff or wear glasses or need help buttoning his shirt. He hated being smart in math. He knew what X over the square root of Y equals.
So tell me,
I said.
There are some things you don't want to know.
Leo Luhan thought he was cool. He sat with us because we, and only we, thought so too. Joe Brody sat with us because the other kids who were in as much trouble as Joe had skipped the rest of the school day. Jim Fisk was too thoughtful to sit anywhere else. He was practicing to get on the debate team. We listened to Resolved, the United States should not sell wheat to the Soviet Union because a Soviet Union wheat surplus will be used to build nuclear warheads. In return, Jim listened to physics equations that proved high school doesn't exist, why the Kingston Trio would change American music forever, tales from detention, how Martha Graham's contribution to modern dance had transformed West Side Story, and concerns about Green Beret headgear. And Al Bartz was too thoughtless to sit anywhere else. He was funny. He could fart at will. Of course, I had nothing in common with my new friends either. That was different. Jerry Harris farted a lot, but not at will. What I could do at will, and even more so when I willed otherwise, was get erections. Perhaps something needs to be said about the human penis, after all. I would get an erection hurrying from class to class between bells so that I'd have to carry my books like a girl. Carrying my books like a girl provoked enough thought of girls to give me another erection in class. Then I would be called on to stand up and give an answer about the independence of emerging African nations and why it was like the new frontier. If it weren't for the protective spread of open three-ring binders propped on desktops, there would be no adult male baby boomers. We all would have died of embarrassment. I'd get an erection at the family dinner table and have to carefully dawdle over my lima beans for reasons other than Kukla, Fran, and Ollie. I'd get an erection at Uncle Walter's cottage when my older cousin Shirley wore a two-piece bathing suit that revealed her navel. I'd have to stand around in water up to my waist for no reason while Uncle Timmy accused me of peeing in the lake. I always had an erection in the morning. Someone should have taken my mother aside and solemnly informed her, "If you ask a boy to get out of bed and he says he doesn't want to, don't insist, not even if he's late for school. He may have personal, private reasons for not wanting to." Our turgid toy fox terrier Pee-wee had died, just when I was beginning to sympathize with his plight. But Pee-wee wanted to hump everything, the indicator of my desire, like a compass needle. Apt simile for a 100-pound, 5-foot-2-inch boy who spent half an hour every night examining legs, underarms, and groin in hope of a dark hair, swung around to the magnetic north of sophomore Marcia Matheson in the frozen terrain of the hopeless crush. If self-consciousness is the salient trait of the baby boom, the crush is the signal emotion. Our generation is not given to tragic passion, to tragic. Nor are we much for stolid affection that matures and strengthens with age. March 1, 2012, item from the New York Times. Over the past 20 years, the divorce rate among baby boomers has surged by more than 50%. The perfect love is the crush. Romeo and Juliet, without the plot resolution. What's the harm in it? We're an expansive generation. We would discover that we could have a dozen crushes at once, while even three or four simultaneous affairs led to complications. Nor did our crushes need to be limited to persons. We could fall for groups of people, social classes, ethnicities, races. In a few years, we'd show up wearing bell-bottoms, work shirts, Stetsons, braids, clunky turquoise jewelry, and sandals. Smitten by various exotic types, we'd imitate the dress of sailors, ditch diggers, cowboys, Indians, Mexican peasants, and Jesus all in one outfit. We'd get crushes on moods. Groovy. We'd get crushes on slogans, make love, not war. Fortunately, we got over that one before we had to apply it to Osama bin Laden. We'd get crushes on abstract ideas, the whole earth. And we still do. The balanced budget. We'd have passions for diseases. Everybody had mono. Then it was chronic fatigue syndrome. Now it's Asperger's. And all our children are allergic to peanuts. Philosophies, politics, and religions have been the objects of our unrequited love. From Jean-Paul Sartre, we'd find out what's up with being and nothingness. Nothing, as far as I could tell from the book. The liberal consensus meant you won't have Nixon to kick around anymore. He was fibbing. And it turns out the Maharishi Mahesh Yogi smiles like that at everybody. We would feel unrequited love for love itself. All you need is unrequited love. And our crushes would last as long as we cared to let them. Love never dies when what you love doesn't know you're alive. However, in 1961, I was a beginner with crushes. Marcia Matheson was a slight girl, almost elfin. A full-sized homecoming queen would have been aiming too high, even for the permanently elevated angle of my imagination. Besides, Marcia Matheson had wonderful qualities all her own. She lived 10 blocks from me, and at night I'd walk in drizzle or slush or biting cold to observe those qualities. That is, to observe the lighted windows of the house in which those qualities were displayed. Inside, at the Matheson dinner table, Marcia was giving her opinion about selling wheat to the Soviet Union and what X over the square root of Y should equal. She was laughing at how Al Bartz had commandeered the school PA system and announced that Federal Communications Commission Chairman Newton N. Minow's speech to the school assembly about the vast wasteland had been canceled due to a scheduling conflict with wagon train. But she didn't laugh at Leo Luhan for bumping into a drinking fountain because he was wearing sunglasses indoors, being cool. She liked modern dance, but not enough to walk like a duck. If she had a chance, she'd let Joe Brody drive her dad's Corvette. That was her dad's Corvette, the one parked near her house. Sometimes, I was sure of it. In the blue television glow behind the living room curtains, Mr. and Mrs. Matheson were watching reruns of Jackie Kennedy's White House tour. They'd say, I was too young for Marcia and too wild at heart. Marcia was bored by old furniture. The light on upstairs, that was her in her bedroom, flipping through a fashion magazine with an eye to getting the U.S. Special Forces into uniforms of the latest style. And she was fantasizing about having sex with someone less hairy than a sophomore or a junior or a senior boy, in every imaginable position. I knew of 3. Sometimes there was a light on in the basement, where the workshop would be. Marcia harbored a secret fondness for customizing plastic model cars. I never said anything about my crush. Al Bartz would have made some wisecrack, called her Bluey, the M&M that's not in the pack. I did mention her name to Billy Stumpf. I mean, you can't not ever speak of the eternal love of your life. Billy was a sophomore and maybe new. Yeah, Billy said, melts in your mouth, not in your hand. I had nothing in common with my old friends now, but we did that nothing together most weekends. Billy was out for the season with a ruptured spleen. Bobby Stumpf was still in 8th grade, but he was bigger than any of the rest of us. Johnny McKay didn't like Northside High. Steve Penske was having trouble being Hoodie. He was expected to pick on littler kids. And there weren't many kids who were littler, except me, and he had already suffered the effects of my roundhouse right. Unfiltered cigarettes made him sneeze. He liked menthols, which were for girls. And it turns out, ham radio is not Hoodie. Jerry Harris was still in eighth grade, too, but Mr. Harris didn't notice if we got into the chartreuse or even the Bailey's Irish cream. We could do anything we wanted in the Harris basement as long as we didn't smoke near the guppies. When Joe Brody came over, we planned to make trouble like we used to, but we seemed to have lost the knack. Sometimes we'd go to where road work was being done on Central Avenue and rearrange the traffic cones so that drivers found themselves in a lane too narrow to pass through. Joe had an idea for a prank on Johnny's high school. The Polar Bears' homecoming game was next week. They'd be playing the Cowboys. We'd get a ton of weed killer and write, "Bears Bite," on the football field grass, which would get brown and dead just in time for the game. We didn't have enough money for a ton of weed killer, but Mr. Biedermeier was a fanatic about his lawn, and he'd have lots in his garage. We'd catch Joe's stepdad at just the right moment, a six-pack into being good-natured, and tell him a story about donating weed killer to a poor family on the north side of town who couldn't afford to take care of their yard. He'd put the seven of us in his car with the weed killer in the trunk and drop us off behind the Polar Bears stadium. We'd wait until late at night and scale the chain-link fence. Note how, later, the aging baby boom, having never forgotten our youthful dreams and aspirations, would equip every place with surveillance cameras as soon as they were invented. And we'd work by matchlight and Zippo flame until past midnight, spreading weed killer in big block letters. But Mr. Biedermeier's garage was locked. I told Anna Klein all about Marcia Matheson. Girls understand these things. Anna asked me if I wanted to see West Side Story. Her parents balked at going for the fourth time. Taking Anna to see West Side Story was not, per se, a date. It was a mutual attendance at a cultural event. As with television, tail fins, the suburbs, fads, and JFK, movies are supposed to have had a profound influence on the baby boom. And maybe they did. At the end of a good 1960s movie, the characters died, especially if they were the characters that the baby boom audience liked, not just in West Side Story, but in The Alamo, Spartacus, To Kill a Mockingbird, Bonnie and Clyde, and Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. At the end of Dr. Strangelove, everybody dies. This taught the baby boom a lesson. In marketing, if our generation had been running the movie industry when Dr. Strangelove was in production, Stanley Kubrick would have been fired and replaced with Todd Phillips, and Slim Pickens would have ridden his H-bomb into a Mai Tai being drunk by Zach Galifianakis, where it would have fizzled, and Dr. Strangelove would be a franchise with Part 8 coming soon in 3D to a multiplex near you. As I was saying, taking Anna to see West Side Story was not a date. Anna and I never dated, but we experienced the painful logistics of early teenage dating. My mother drove. If my mother and Anna and I all sat in the front seat, we'd look ridiculous. If I sat in the back, Anna would be exposed to inquiries from my understanding mother. My mother had taken dance classes when she was a girl. She and Anna might have a conversation. And if I sat in the front and Anna sat in the back, my mother would drag me into the conversation, doubling the embarrassment. Baby boom parents were picking up on ideas from Mr. Keeble and other adults. Mom would try to engage us. The whole adult world was failing to keep its distance. The generation gap was a hope long before it was a catchphrase. Anna and I both sat in the back. I insisted that we be dropped off three blocks from the movie theater. I didn't get West Side Story. The West Side was a good part of town, although parts of the North Side were nice, too. Prevailing winds blew factory smoke to the smelly East Side. The teenagers, who seemed to be going on 30, were supposed to be hoods, but they were singing songs and dancing like Anna Klein. And the Jets wore gym shoes. Steve Penske would never wear gym shoes. hoodie kids wore black pointy shoes from Tom McCann. We were reading Romeo and Juliet in freshman English. Mrs. Orpington, the English teacher, said West Side Story was Romeo and Juliet retold. But the Montagues and Capulets were both Italians, like the Jets were, although none of the Jet families seemed to own Italian restaurants, and the Sharks were from Puerto Rico and talked like Speedy Gonzales. Tony and Maria on a fire escape was sort of the same as the balcony scene in Act Two, but they were on a fire escape, so it was sort of the same as a Mad Magazine parody of the balcony scene in Act Two. And what kind of name was Jets for a teenage gang? Over in Cleveland, there was a teenage gang called the Vicejoys. That was more like it. If Romeo and Juliet hadn't kept going on and on about whether it's larks or whether it's nightingales, they would have had time to do it again in Act Three before Lady Capulet started hollering. Then they die. Mr. Keeble talked about West Side Story and Romeo and Juliet, too. The underlying issues were relevant to the poverty problems in America today, and the resulting conflict was relevant to the Katanga Rebellion. If the United Nations Charter had been in force in Verona, the UN would have intervened with the Capulets and Montagues the way Dag Hammarskjöld intervened in the Congo, Mr. Keeble said. Dag Hammarskjöld died. At the end of West Side Story, Maria doesn't die. At least, I think she doesn't. By that time, Anna Klein was in tears, and I was in mystification. I put my arm around Anna and said, "There, there," because that's what men said to women who are crying, as opposed to what boys said to girls who are crying, which is, "Knock it off." When the movie was over, my mother was waiting in the car right outside, instead of three blocks away. I pulled my arm free and looked at Anna and said, "Knock it off." Years would pass before I realized Anna Klein was cute, and she liked me. For a knowing generation, we got off to a slow start. Myself, when young, did eagerly frequent doctor and saint, and heard great argument about it and about, but evermore came out by the same door wherein I went. Edward Fitzgerald, The Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam. 8. Agents of Influence. Adolescence is a time of discovery. The baby boom discovered beer. At about the same time we discovered beer, we discovered that, now we were older, our parents went out at night. We never wondered where they went. Possibly, the greatest generation had a social life. To us, it seemed unlikely. We were the center of the universe, and if our parents weren't orbiting close by, then they were out in the void of space, where events that didn't immediately concern us took place. Meanwhile, we also discovered that Jim Fisk, with the serious expression on his face, looked almost old enough to buy beer. Not that the clerk at Lefty's Package Goods paid much attention to a customer's appearance as long as he appeared to be tall enough to reach the counter with $1.10 for a six-pack of Blatz. We'd go over to somebody's house that night. His parents were out. Beer was the miracle multivitamin of baby boom male adolescence. The necessary requirements for our generational growth were provided in large doses. Beer gave us the confidence to deal with our salient trait of self-consciousness. Beer quelled our reserve about divulging the secrets of our signal emotion, the crush. Beer made us brave, cheerful, and sick all over the kitchen floor. The effects of beer were extraordinary. What else could have made a teenage boy mop the kitchen? Then Mom and Dad come home, and the place still reeks of beer and vomit. Mom goes upstairs, not being understanding for once, which is a relief, and making loud sighing noises. And Dad sits you down for the first man-to-man talk since the sex one. It's a rite of passage. "I guess this is what they call a rite of passage," Dad says. Without beer, and assuming the reader was as bad at being a loud-mouthed, obnoxious high school sports star as I was, what would there be for a Greatest Generation dad to take a certain sneaking pride in? Beer has been good to the baby boom. Our greatest achievement has been in the field of communications. We were just then developing our first form of new media, the instant, high-speed dissemination of our ideas and opinions for which the baby boom is famous, and mooning people never would have occurred to us if it hadn't been for beer. One of our ideas and opinions is that inhibitions are unhealthy. Inhibitions are almost as unhealthy as guilt. Beer is health food. We wished we could get the girls to partake more. We wished we could come up with a special beer for girls. It's a problem. What is beer for baby boom girls? Sometimes, of course, it was beer. Although the girls got more silly than uninhibited, they made it to the bathroom before they threw up, and they never made it with us. We're supposed to be a generation with a short attention span, but we worked on the beer for girls problem for 20 years. Matisse Rosé? Wine coolers? Pot? LSD? As it turns out, cocaine was beer for baby boom girls. Cocaine is not health food. Alas. Another baby boom idea is that we know everything. And now we do, thanks to the Internet. But we already have the secret to learning what's what. You can click on an icon, or you can pull on a pop top. Information is one beer away. Al Bartz informed us that the Blatz Brewery was started by a distant relative of his, but that the Japanese immigrants in Milwaukee couldn't pronounce Bartz because, phonetically, the letter L is almost the same as the letter R, except that L is an alveolar lateral, while R is an alveolar glide. Al had done a paper on phonetics for extra credit in AP English titled, Why the Japanese Say Rots of Ruck. The baby boom's greatest achievement of all has been in the field of bullshit. We excel not merely at communicating, but at marketing, public relations, political campaigning, high finance, law, the oracular sciences, everything to do with the World Wide Web, and all professions that employ important-sounding jargon. Yet another baby boom idea is that life is like high school. We are the first generation to make this claim. It's hard to imagine the GIs of D-Day standing around on Omaha Beach saying, life is like high school. Life was not like high school in ancient times, although a prom date with Henry VIII could turn out to have a carry ending. Nowhere in the philosophy of Plato does the phrase, life is like Plato's Symposium, appear. But if you consider the role that bullshit plays in the modern world, life is like high school. I mean, bullshit as no insult. The Greatest Generation created the atomic bomb. The baby boom created the story that Saddam Hussein had one. Please do not answer the question which was worse, Hiroshima or the George W. Bush administration. If you voted for Dick Gregory, John Anderson, Lyndon LaRouche, Ross Perot, or Ron Paul. Especially don't answer it if you voted for all five. Our generation is identified with drugs. Use of drugs has declined, because we took them all. But it was beer that revealed our true qualities, and memo to Generation X with your microbreweries and your hops and malt snobs, beer is quantitative. Speaking of which, our parents drank more than we do. Why wasn't alcohol the path to success for them? Probably it had something to do with their guilt and inhibitions. I'll have to ask Al Bartz. He became a psychiatrist. Using our talent as communicators, we communicated the baby boom idea that we are each perfectly unique by acting in complete unison with a clique, which we pronounced click, of six or eight other kids who we thought were just like us. That way, the one-of-a-kind nature of ourself was multiplied by six or eight, enough to make an impact on life, which is like high school. In the high school of the early baby boom, everyone dressed the same. This was how we communicated our idea that we were nonconformists. Identical clothing demonstrated the individualism of the baby boom. Tim Minsky, being good at math, explained it after two beers. The theory of quantum mechanics predicts that infinite random behavior results in universal laws of physics. The universal law at our high school was boys wore penny loafers with white wool socks, chinos, and long-sleeved madras shirts. Individualism was expressed when the madras bled on Dad's white dress shirts. Girls wore penny loafers, too, with white cotton ankle socks, pleated tartan skirts, and Peter Pan collar blouses embellished with circle pins. Boys told each other that a circle pin meant a girl was a virgin. Whether it was meant to mean that or not, it did. This style was known as collegiate. Any college would do, even the two-year college downtown. Kids who were going to work instead of college didn't need to communicate nonconformity and could wear anything they liked, except blue jeans. The school authorities forbade work clothes in school. However, the school authorities said we had to work hard in school. Otherwise, when we left school, we'd have to do hard work, probably wearing blue jeans. Question authority, as the aging dork in a Prius who held me up in traffic this morning said on his bumper sticker. Questions of legal, moral, and institutional authority began to be fiercely debated in public schools. The fierce debate of the 1962-63 school year was whether white Levi's were blue jeans. Today, the question of whether students should be given condoms is fiercely debated in public schools. Speaking as someone who carried around the same Trojan until it wore a white ring in the leather of my wallet, it's amazing how much bullshit our generation has piled on legal, moral, and institutional authority. The fierce debate of the 1963-64 school year would be whether students should be given haircuts. Anyway, were white Levi's blue jeans? The school authorities maintained they were Levi's. The students maintained they were white. Parents and teachers got involved. Jim Fisk's debate team advisor changed the debate topic from selling wheat to Russia to resolved. White Levi's are not appropriate apparel for school. We're a generation that doesn't back down on matters of principle. Starting in 1963, boys at our high school wore penny loafers with white wool socks, white Levi's, and long-sleeved madras shirts. White Levi's weren't the only pressing issue of the day. Mr. Collingwood, the biology teacher, interrupted class during the Cuban Missile Crisis. He told us that this was a very grave crisis. There was a genuine threat of nuclear war. We should have a class discussion. My biology lab partner, Susan, was no Marcia Matheson, but she was cute enough that I had dissected a frog for her. I told Susan, we could be dead next week. You and I should, you know, do it. Susan gave me a look like she'd given the frog when it came out of the jar of formaldehyde. No, seriously, I said. We don't want to die virgins. Susan gave me a different look, more like the one when I had pulled her frog over to my side of the table and, shielding her view with my madras-clad elbow, recited the names of frog innards so she could label the diagram in her lab notebook. She said she needed time to think. She'd give me her answer on Monday. Then the Cuban Missile Crisis was over. Darn it. Pressing issues were becoming popular. Class was interrupted more often. We discussed mutually assured destruction and civil rights. Even parents wanted to have discussions. Anna Klein's father was a doctor. Her mother volunteered at the city's Planned Parenthood clinic. There was no TV in their living room. They owned hardback books. They had a poster of Matisse's La Danse on the rec room wall, and they used cloth napkins on weeknights. Dr. Klein turned to me at dinner and asked, "What do you think about civil rights?" Was I supposed to argue? Saying, "Civil rights are great," didn't sound right either. I had very little experience of anybody talking about anything at the dinner table. I said, "Civil rights are the pressing issue of the day." Dr. Klein nodded with grave approval. "But civil rights were, paradoxically, almost as damaging to the baby boom's understanding of the nature of evil as superhero comic books and Hannah Arendt. I hope nobody who was completely right about something that was completely wrong will take offense, but baby boomers would end up thinking that each pressing issue of the day, no matter which side of the issue the baby boomer is on at the moment, is a matter of, as it were, black and white." Of course, Anna and the rest of us did talk about civil rights and other pressing issues when we were by ourselves. Dr. and Mrs. Klein went out a lot. They had a wine cellar. That is, they had a cellar with a cupboard that had wine in it. We tried Manischewitz. That makes a real mess on the kitchen floor. Anna and Leo Luhan were determined to become freedom riders. Anna was indignant that Westside High School wasn't integrated. Leo thought the way white people in Mississippi talked, dressed, and acted wasn't cool. They had a plan to be freedom riders on the city bus that ran back and forth along Coolidge Avenue between the Westside High School district and the city's black neighborhood. And Joe Brody had a paper bag full of bus token slugs. But before they could get organized, Coach Guernsey, who coached the Westside Cowboys football team, started worrying that Westside wasn't getting any of the Negro kids who were good at playing football. A former Cowboy football star who sold real estate found a house in the Westside School District for the family of the black neighborhood's best running back. The house was on a street with a lot of new immigrants who didn't speak English well enough to say prejudiced things. People like Coach Guernsey and the former football star real estate salesman don't seem to come up in any Ken Burns saga of the American Civil Rights Movement, and I suppose Coach's motives for integrating Westside High wouldn't have made for an elevating classroom discussion about civil rights. But the running back was always called on to explain how it felt to be discriminated against. Tim Minsky, Jim Fisk, and I signed up for Model UN. We did it to get excused from Jim. At Model UN, the pressing issue was, should communist China be admitted? The answer was no. It would lead to an imbalance for Chinese communists. Later, the answer would be yes. It would lead to a balance for Russian communists. Philip Wu, the only Chinese kid in the city school system that we knew of, did not sign up. His parents owned a Chinese restaurant. Maybe they would have liked 800 million more customers. Model UN was held downtown in the drafty auditorium of the two-year college. There were about 100 high school student delegates, the kind who want to get excused from gym. I can't remember anything else, and wouldn't if I could. Nothing produces more useless tedium than Model UN, except the UN. The Greatest Generation was pretending it was good Cold War strategy to send a bunch of kids someplace to argue about things they didn't understand. In a couple of years, the Greatest Generation would quit pretending. In a couple of years, the Greatest Generation would really believe it was good Cold War strategy to send a bunch of kids someplace, someplace worse than a drafty auditorium, to do something worse than argue about things they still didn't understand. The baby boom's greatest achievement has been in the field of bullshit, but we didn't invent it. No. No, for my virginity. When I lose that, says Rose, I'll die. Behind the elms last night, cried Dick. Rose, were you not extremely sick? Matthew Prior, A True Maid. 9. The Prelude. Bliss was it in that dawn to be alive, but to be young was very heaven, as William Wordsworth said when he got his driver's license. The baby boom's first social movement
was cruising.
This is not to be confused with cruising. Adolescence on wheels, as it is, poorly remembered in popular culture and badly reenacted in Plymouth Belvederes by old bald guys. I never saw a car hop wearing roller skates. The idea was as stupid then as it is now. Nor did we cruise in the singles bar or Christopher Street sense, loitering with sexual intent. We were full of sexual intentions, and we could loiter, but we had a broader agenda. We drove around and around. Our parents didn't understand cruising. They thought we were driving around to find a place to drink and make out. Not that we weren't, but the greatest generation, with its dull powers of fancy, never suspected that our goal was to have no goal at all. Life is a journey, not a destination, as Ralph Waldo Emerson said when he got his driver's license. We had the perfect, pointless joy of freedom. It wasn't just our parents who didn't understand. Neither do we anymore. We, as grown-ups, tell ourselves as kids, and tell our own kids, freedom is a serious responsibility, or freedom means making important choices. Or, if we've had a couple of drinks and are listening to an oldies station, freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose. We as kids tell ourselves as grown-ups, no, it's not, and no, it doesn't. And our kids tell us that Janis Joplin needed autotune. I leave it to others to decide whether, over the years, the baby boom has gained sophistication concerning the ontological question of free will. We drove around and around. There were a few little red sports cars, hot rods, custom jobs, and bitching sets of wheels. Very few. Turning 16 caused our parents to break out in a rash of vehicular insipidity. Any good baby boom boy my age can testify that the oomph went out of American family car design in 1963. Dad bought Mom a snappy convertible back about the time of the Nixon-Kennedy debates. When we got our driver's license, he traded it in on a station wagon. Only rich kids with indulgent parents and poor kids with after-school jobs had their own cars. And thus began the political trend of angry middle-class resentment. The middle class is furious, or at least as furious as middle class proprieties allow. You've seen it in the firebrand, well, Weber grill charcoal lighter, demagoguery, and the crass rabble-rousing, though we're not rabble, so call it Babbitt-rousing, of recent elections, and on Morning Joe. Once the baby boom had gone through all its rudimentary phases of ideological development, from revolutionary pimples to Reaganite hip replacement, the true politics of our generation would be revealed. In America, the reasonably well-off and moderately comfortable are the angry masses. It has to do with borrowing Mom's car. Jim Fisk tried seriously to make the best of things. He showed everybody how one pull on a lever caused the whole front seat of his mother's Nash Rambler to fold down into a bed. Anna Klein said, "You're going to pull the lever and some girl's going to flip over backward and break her neck." "No girl," said Al Bartz, "is willing to be seen dead in a Nash Rambler." Turning 16 caused us to break out in a rash of unwanted helpfulness. "I'll go to the supermarket, Mom. We're almost out of paprika." We drove around and around. The cars got bad mileage, but gas was 31 cents a gallon. We could get to where all the other kids were by looking under the couch cushions. Unspoken consensus made driving up and down certain streets obligatory, and parking in certain places required. Sometimes when we parked, we were parking, as the art of love was called. And sometimes when we parked, we were parked. We got out of our cars to talk to each other. We're a talkative generation, and only so much can be shouted from a car window. We got out of our cars, but not away from them. That would have been like separating the body from the soul. Or Not to overstate the case, it would have been like getting too far from a bathroom for the males among us 50 years later. We lounged against the fenders. We perched on the trunk lids. We stood in the open doors, with one foot resting on the sill and an elbow cocked on the roof, looking cool. It wasn't just Leo Luan who thought he was cool. Now we all did. And the cars of those days didn't ruin looking cool with nagging ding-dong noises if you left the car door open and the keys in the ignition. It's heavy lifting, conducting light flirtations. Much effort goes into crafting an effortless guise. We worked up an appetite. Drive-in burger restaurants played a crucial role in cruising. They were parking lots with food. We had plenty to talk to each other about, and plenty of each other to talk to. The baby boom was discovering itself, and not in the tiresome way that we would keep doing for the rest of our lives until, by now, every rock in our psyche has been overturned and each wiggling thing we've found underneath has been squashed or made into a pet. Youth was discovering youth. Not only were there lots of us, there were lots more of us. Other kids went to other high schools. The boys were almost as cool. The girls were even cuter. Driving around was our Facebook. We never thought to monetize it. Generational vice or generational virtue? We drove around and around, and we talked and talked. We talked about what's cool and what's uncool. No one listens when teenagers talk, including the teenagers themselves most of the time. But teenagers were, and still are in present-day text messages, having an ancient colloquy of deep significance. What we discussed appears in the Revised Standard Version of the Bible, Proverbs 17:27. He who has a cool spirit is a man of understanding. Cool. The Oxford English Dictionary cites a line from a Chaucer poem. Thinkest in thine wit that is full cool. Spelling bees are uncool. In 1938, Eric Partridge, the 20th century's preeminent lexicographer of slang, gave a cool definition of cool in A Dictionary of Slang and Unconventional English. Impertinent, impudent, audacious, especially if in a calm way. This was in common use by the mid-1820s, standard English by the mid-1880s, and exactly what we were talking about by the mid-1960s. In 2010, Partridge's lexicographic heir, Jonathan Green, author of the 6,000-page Green's Dictionary of Slang, devoted 18 column inches to cool and said, as with a number of slang's rare abstract terms, it is less than simple to draw hard and fast lines between the senses. We've been out of our senses a lot. The baby boom was always less than simple. Forget the hard and fast lines. We are a fiery generation, heated in our affection, feverish in our action, blistering in our scorn, and obsessed with being cool. Later, we'd be a fat generation obsessed with being fit. We still think we're cool. That isn't all. We still think we're hot. Good thing we talked this out while we were driving around. The music we listened to was cool. The power of our generation is our music. But in the interest of speaking truth to power, I looked at the Billboard Top 100 for the year I went from junior to senior in high school. We liked Everybody Loves Somebody by Dean Martin, number 6, better than we liked The Beatles' Can't Buy Me Love, number 52. We liked We'll Sing in the Sunshine by Gail Garnett, number 8, better than we liked The Kinks' You Really Got Me, number 78. The Rolling Stones didn't make the chart. Leo Luan had mentioned them. He said you could tell their music was influenced by the Kingsmen's Louie Louie. Here are the actual lyrics to Louie Louie as posted on the Internet a medium that does not spare our sensibilities. Louie Louai, oh no, me gotta go. I said, Louie Louai, oh baby.